captured. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have today two discipline cases. The first is 03-1184-D, OLR versus Richard Bolte. Mr. Gimbel representing Mr. Bolte.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Schwarzenbach. I am Frank Gimbel, and I am here representing Richard Bolte in connection with this matter, which is one that flows from a decision made by a referee in an Office of Lawyer Regulation case. Richard Bolte is a person who was admitted to the State Bar of Wisconsin in 1961. Footnote, he was my grade school and high school classmate. In 1989.
Oh, listen, that's going to prejudice me now, I think. That he was your grade school and high school classmate.
Yes.
Guilt by association, I'm talking about.
If this turns out right.
Okay.
In any event, in 1989, Rick Bolte left the practice of law, left the state of Wisconsin, shows up in conversation with a woman who has not had great luck with lawyers in dealing with Arco Oil Company in regard to what she believed to be their fudging on their responsibilities to pay her lease payments, and finds Mr. Bolte, encourages and persuades him to assist her by investigating leases that she has and other materials that might shed some light on whether her at least indications are that she's getting shortchanged in payments that are being made. So in November of 1994...
Mr. Gimbel, I just have one question, and I know perhaps we cannot go beyond what we have in these documents, but it appears to me, and not only in both briefs, that Mr. Bolte was sought out by this, how do you pronounce your last name, Cusco?
Cusco, yes.
There was no, apparently he was not known to her in any other capacity, and he was known to be a lawyer. I believe that's it, right?
She knew. I don't believe he knew to be a lawyer. He knew that this was one of those like truck stop introductions, okay, as I recall. And there's this guy who wears cowboy boots and jeans who's pretty smart. Maybe he can help you. And I think that was the genesis of the introduction.
And she had sought out at least five other non-legal people to help her, as I understand from the facts here.
She had sought out a number of people, okay, including lawyers. Okay. To help her, and was not successful. Now, some of that might have been the baggage she brought to the meeting, but that aside, the fact is that come November of 1994, they enter an agreement. She does know he's a lawyer. She does know he is not a licensed lawyer in the state of Colorado. She does know that he is not authorized to practice law in the state of Colorado. And they very carefully, I suggest to you, craft a descriptive document that explains what responsibilities he is willing to undertake for her with some financial terms that essentially provide an incentive for him to be successful in connection with these matters. And then what happens, of course, is that he does develop a paper that suggests that she has a claim against Arco for being shortchanged. He recommends that she hire a specialist lawyer. They go on a shopping trip, find a specialist lawyer in Denver, a man named George Miller. And thereafter, Mr. Miller and Ms. Cosgrove enter into an agreement whereby Mr. Miller is going to pursue the case that Bolte believes exists as a consequence of his investigation. There is, at least from the point of view of the referee's findings, a conclusion reached by him, and I suggest that the referee's decision in this matter is extraordinarily well done. It really captures all of the facts of the relationship between Ms. Costco and Richard Bolte, and it very eloquently, in my view, takes us, meaning me and all of you today, through the history of these two individuals. The only thing that the referee did was he tripped on the track in two instances, and where he tripped on the track was that he ultimately reached the conclusion that there was a period of time between November of 1994, when this agreement was signed, until January of 1995, when the decision was made to engage Mr. Miller to proceed with this case, where Richard Bolte stepped into the role of a practicing lawyer. Our position has been and is here today, and we urge you to look at the position that we're asserting here today, that Richard Bolte never did trespass into the area of practicing law in this two-month period of time. And additionally, that if you find with a microscopic examination of his behavior that he did, that he nonetheless, as a consequence of the fact that after the engagement of Mr. Miller, he was admitted pro hac vice to act.
I have a question about
this. Yes.
Okay. He says, and I'm reading from 108 of the appendix, which is the referee report, I'm a sole practitioner resident of Wisconsin. I'm assuming that's true. Temporary office in Colorado. And I'm admitted to the state bar and et cetera. And I'm a member in good standing since 61. Now, he was inactive at that time?
That is correct.
What does inactive mean?
Inactive means that before you can practice law in the state of Wisconsin, you have to come before the Board of Bar Examiners and meet certain requirements to demonstrate that you've kept up your academic skills and ask for reinstatement to active status.
All right. So is that an accurate statement to make to the district court?
You're
admitted to the bar and you're in good standing?
I believe it is. I believe it is, and not only was it Mr. Bolte's statement, but he solicited a letter from Mr. McCarthy of the office I think it was BAPRA at the time, saying that he was, in fact, in good standing with the state bar, had never been the subject of any disciplinary proceedings, but was currently on inactive status. And, in fact, the referee in this case, Chief, did find that with respect to that allegation of inappropriate behavior, the application for pro hoc vice status, that the Office of Law Regulation had not met its burden.
That's covered in 22.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Item 22. I have another question.
Sure.
What happened in Colorado? Just give it to me quickly.
Well,
What did the Colorado finding have?
The Colorado court found that he had practiced law without a license, and they disgorged his fees. He had collected $308,000 from Ms. Cosgrove. She paid that willingly because he had performed under his contract, which was executed in November of 1994. She sent an emissary to him and said, "You've got under the contract at least a claim for additional compensation. My client wants you to give that up, or we're coming against you to get the money back and charge you with unauthorized practice law." Bolte said, "No deal. I don't want to give it up." You know, hindsight is 20/20.
The deal was not to give up his $388,000. The deal was to give up his future possibilities, right?
That is accurate. Yeah, they didn't ask him for a refund.
Right.
No.
He could have kept his $380,000 and walked away.
That is correct. But nonetheless, he apparently... one might say, felt that he was being given a Hobson's choice, kind of intimidated, and he's not easily intimidated. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be here if he was more easily intimidated, but he wasn't. The Colorado courts bought into the argument that was made by Ms. Costco, that, in fact, he, by his behavior at a time prior to the time of his admission into the federal district court in Denver, pro hac vice, did, in fact, practice law and gave the remedy that the Colorado statute provided.
Is there any dispute between the parties or in the Colorado proceedings that about the facts here, that is, namely, what Mr. Bolte did for Ms. Costco?
I don't think that that the Office of Law Regulation and I have a dispute about the facts. We have a dispute about how the facts are interpreted.
That's right. But and in Colorado, it was the same facts?
It appears that the same facts were there. Now, not having been involved in any way in that litigation, I don't know how that was presented, Chief. Okay, so I like to think that if I was his lawyer, he wouldn't be here either, that he should have won the case there, but he didn't. And that's a reality.
Okay, the point of my questions is this. One reason that everybody agrees that the Colorado decision about practicing unauthorized practice of law is that there's a different standard of proof. Is that right?
That is accurate.
But standard of proof seems to me to go to proving the facts, not the legal issue of what is the unauthorized practice of law. So that's why I say to you, I don't think there's a dispute as to what he did. He did this investigation. He suggested this. He interpreted that. And that I suggest, I'm not sure, all of that was undisputed. Therefore, the only issue is a legal issue of do these undisputed facts meet unauthorized practice of law? Now, that's what my problem is.
All right, well, let me try to solve your problem. Yes. That's what I'm here for. There is here, and it seems to me I'm always talking about bridges when I'm in the Supreme Court in the year 2005, but there is here, it seems to me, a need for the prosecution of this case against Mr. Bolte for unauthorized practice to show that the facts that are really not in dispute cross over from investigative services and appropriately activities that are not within the framework of unauthorized practice of law and into the area of unauthorized law. And I suggest to the court today that they built the bridge in Colorado, and Mr. Warnarski didn't buy into that. So I think that really what Mr. Warnarski said in his decision here is more than just that there's a different burden of proof. I think that what he says is that looking at the responsibilities of the Office of Law and Regulation to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Bolte practiced law without a license there, they had the burden of proving it. And what he ultimately said was, and I think this is quite telling, on page 125 of the appendix.
On it.
Your Honor, I thought you would be. He says, I do not find that the instances where Bolte overstepped the bounds of proper investigative and entered into the unauthorized practice of law to be numerous in comparison with the totality of the complex case. Nonetheless, Bolte did on occasion engage in the unauthorized practice of law, and OLR has sustained its burden in those instances. And I'm suggesting to the court today that there really was fly-specking by the referee here when, first of all, he took the universe of time in this case down to 2 months, really, essentially, from November 22nd to the end of January 1995. And that's the only period of time within which he finds that there was, in fact, this unauthorized practice of law. He isolates it even further, and defines on page 124 of his decision, that is 124 of the appendix, where he says that, and I'm going back a page before that to 123, Bolte was engaged primarily in fact-finding. This was not the practice of law, but rather permissible investigative-type services by an individual with legal training. Bolte's Wisconsin license was not revoked or suspended, but rather he was on inactive status. It goes on to say, however, Bolte became more and more involved in the investigation. The evidence shows that in his zealousness to learn the truth and help Costco, he occasionally began overstepping the bounds between serving as an investigator and acting as a lawyer. Thus, many of the instances of the alleged unauthorized practice of law cited by OLR are actually a combination of permissible investigative activities by Bolte and the impermissible practice of law by Bolte. And then he goes on to talk about four of those things, which I suggest to you that if you look at them, I would suggest that any one of us individually looking at them alone, and of course you'll have to look at them collectively, would have an ability to argue whether they truly do reflect practice of law.
Well, Mr. Gimbel, let me ask you about one of those instances.
Sure.
I'm looking at the brief dated March 30th. I'm looking in the red appendix at page 130 and 131. And after reading the conclusions of the referee, I'm looking at page 131 in the red brief, where Mr. Bolte cites this is your client in the brief, cites a couple of cases.
Okay.
Ezinger and Volkers, Inc., Baum versus National Finance Company, and Amjur in doing an analysis. Now, as I understand the dating sequence, March 30th precedes his motion of November of 95. For pro hoc vice in the federal court and his admittance pro hoc vice in January of 96. This, to me, looks like legal work.
However, understand this. I think the referee appropriately found that any instances of unauthorized practice of law that might fall within the area of this court's review of the Office of Law Regulation activity occurred prior to January of 1995. All of the behavior of Richard Bolte after the decision was made to hire Miller is insulated by Spanos. So all of the behavior of Richard Bolte after the lawyer was hired and then he became a part of the lawyer team is insulated by Spanos. So that anything that occurred after the January of 1995, in my view, does not fall into the area where Mr. Winarski finds that he practiced law without authority. And I think he's made a mistake in his own decision here because he identified three zones of time within which he evaluated the unauthorized practice of law. The first was the time prior to the decision to hire Miller. The second was the time after the decision to hire Miller till the time of the pro hoc vice, and then after the pro hoc vice. He finds that the pro hoc vice admission to the court is not unauthorized practice of law vis-a-vis Spanos. He finds the decision to hire Miller up to the time of the pro hoc vice is under the umbrella of Spanos and is therefore also not unauthorized practice of law, and that's when this March thing happens.
Maybe I'm not understanding your argument, because when you look at page 125 of your brief, in summary, and this goes to the period before the hiring of Miller, in summary, before Miller was retained, the majority of services rendered by Bolte to Costco under their contract took the form of investigation and do not constitute the unauthorized practice of law. Such services were essentially fact-finding. However, the services did gradually include legal opinions, legal advice, and legal services. And he concludes, nonetheless, Bolte did on occasion engage in the unauthorized practice of law, and OLR has sustained its burden in those instances by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence. So what it seems that the referee has done is he's separated out and said, okay, a lot of this stuff is fact-finding, but some of it's not, and in those instances where it's not, OLR has sustained its burden of proof.
And I direct you, Justice Butler, to page 112 of Mr. Winarski's opinion, where in his first conclusion of law, he says, by performing legal services for Cosgrove in the state of Colorado relative to the ARCO lease from November 94 to January 1995, without having been admitted to the practice of law in the state of Colorado, Bolte engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. That's this stage one. If you look again at page 124, where you were looking a few moments ago, to his description of the brief, and that is an event that occurred in March of 1995. So it's inconsistent with his own conclusion. His own conclusion is that the instances of unauthorized practice of law, which weren't covered by Spanos, were January of 95 and earlier, not afterwards. So his decision is inconsistent in that respect because he has insulated the March 1995 behavior by the umbrella of Spanos, which I think was appropriate. I also think that it was inappropriate not to extend the umbrella of Spanos backwards to November of 1994. If you read Judge Friendly, and I recommend this as an enjoyable intellectual exercise, if you read Judge Friendly's hearing after the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decided to hear the Spanos case en banc, and they reversed the original panel on which Friendly was a member. If you read that, I think that it's very clear that what Judge Friendly is telling us is that the umbrella of having once been admitted to a federal court and having license to practice law extends back to all behavior that's related to that representation. And I see I've got the orange light.
Could I ask you, did George Miller initiate any litigation in this case?
Yes.
Where was that?
In the federal court in Colorado, Denver.
He filed the suit?
Yes.
I was sort of under the impression that ARCO filed the suit. That's not correct?
Oh, you know what? It could have been. I know he was in the lawsuit, so I right now I'm drawing a blank on whether who the plaintiff and who the defendant was. But certainly George Miller was the principal lawyer, and it was within that litigation that he moved for the admission of Bolte pro hac vice as his associate counsel.
Well, wouldn't it make quite a bit of difference?
I don't think so. I don't think it makes any difference. I think if you read Spanos, I think what Spanos says is that if there is a federal lawsuit within which a person appears as an authorized lawyer, that trumps the application of state laws inconsistent with the decision of the federal district court admitting the person pro hac vice, and that you no longer can come around states and say, we're going to disagree with the decision to admit this person to the federal court because he doesn't belong to our bar.
Mr. Gimbel, does Spanos distinguish between the time period after the lawyers admitted pro hac vice and prior to the admittance?
You know, what's really curious about this, Justice Butler, is that in Spanos never was admitted to the court. And the trial court found that notwithstanding that, because the admission pro hac vice was kind of like an administrative certainty, he should get the benefit of not having been admitted as though he were admitted. And then the appellate court reversed that, finding that the admission under the state obligation to police its lawyers was a requirement before there could be this insulation. And then in the rehearing, God bless you, in the rehearing, Friendly and a group of his colleagues overruled that theory and held that he should be treated as though he were admitted, and he should have every one of the activities that he did in pursuance of that litigation under the umbrella of, okay, state stay away. And they nullified the ability of the state of New York to come after him.
Right, but my question was, did that proceed from the date that he was admitted or prior to?
But he never was admitted.
He was never admitted.
He was never admitted. That's what I'm telling you. And I'm telling you that what Friendly says in his decision is that the umbrella should be from the time when you start to provide services that are relevant to the litigation.
Did Mr. Bolte incur reasonable expenses in working for Mrs. Cosgrove?
Yes.
And was he required to pay back money that was incurred for reasonable expenses?
My understanding, Justice Prosser, is that the judgment in Colorado was he had to disgorge every dime that he got from this lady, whether it was related to the percentage responsibility or the costs and retainer fees that he got. Thank you.
Could I ask, Mr. Bolte is not practicing law.
That is accurate.
What difference does it make? Well, I want you to put into your words. What difference does it make if he were to be suspended?
Let me tell you what difference. I wouldn't be here. I mean, I'm telling you, this is a throw-in. This is a pro bono thing for me, okay, because of a friendship thing. But in his mind, this is the greatest illustration of the old cliche that no good deed goes unpunished. Here's a guy who, but for his efforts, this lady winds up with nothing, and as a consequence of his effort, gets over $1,800,000, and he gets in return a judgment against him for $400,000, and he's got his pal in front of the Supreme Court trying to protect his integrity, which has been blasphemed in Colorado, and Costco not even satisfied to get the $400,000 in Colorado, not only satisfied that she's chased him into the bushes, but brings a complaint here against his license. I mean, give me a break. Nobody did for Bolte.
Mrs. Cosgrove was the one that filed?
Yes, her lawyer filed the Ola complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Schwarzenbach, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Honorable Justices of this Court, Paul Schwarzenbach representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this matter. On this appeal, Mr. Bolte is challenging the findings and conclusions of referee Winarski. He challenges the findings and conclusions in two respects, one of which I think is the only thing we've gotten to thus far in the argument today, concerns the unauthorized practice claim and the findings and conclusions of the referee. The second aspect of this appeal relates to a claim and a finding and conclusion by the referee that Mr. Bolte violated Supreme Court Rule 20:8.4 sub C by unilaterally conveying title to certain real estate in the state of Colorado 1 week after the District Court for El Paso County, Colorado, had rendered an adverse decision against him in the civil litigation that's been alluded to in the argument thus far today. The first order of business on an appeal in this matter is identifying the standards of review. To the extent that Mr. Bolte is challenging the factual inferences drawn by the referee in this case, the question is whether those factual inferences are clearly erroneous with respect to certain legal issues, and I think particularly the application of the Spanos case, which is touted as some type of silver bullet defense in this case. That would be a conclusion of law which this Court would review independently. I think we've sort of swept over the fact, Your Honors, that this is now the seventh court to have before it the unauthorized practice issue. At page 19 of the OLR's brief in footnote 4, we've identified the six previous courts in which Mr. Bolte has argued with futility that the actions that he undertook in Colorado did not constitute the practice of law. He, in fact, attempted to bring this matter up to the federal court in Colorado, the very federal court that had admitted him pro hac vice more than a year after he began working for Ms. Cosgrove, and that federal district court refused to entertain the case and sent the matter back to state court and said, this is a matter for the state courts. Mr. Bolte took that up to the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit was not interested in that either. Mr. Bolte isn't stopping here. He has now filed a lawsuit in the federal district court, the Western District of Wisconsin. He's now sued the Colorado state court judge. He sued Mrs. Koskov. He sued...
Well, that really isn't before us today, is it? Well, why don't we stick to the issues that we have to decide today?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard,
why do you think that's important?
I think it's important on the issue of sanction, ultimately, Your Honor, and I think we'll come back to that because the referee here concluded, and this is after the referee's decision. The referee concluded that Mr. Bolte is not a danger to the public. I would submit that the proliferation of litigation on this issue demonstrates something quite different.
If he feels he was wronged, is there anything wrong with someone trying to straighten things out?
When we are in the Eighth Court to undertake the issue and there's, I think, plainly a disrespect for the adjudication of the courts of Colorado, that's rather disturbing, Your Honor.
But isn't the burden of proof, I think you started to get at, different in Colorado than it is here?
We have, Justice Butler, we have not argued preclusion in this disciplinary case. This is a separate case.
But because it's a separate case, he has a right to make that argument, doesn't he?
In this court, I'm referring, however, to the federal district court. That's a civil rights case with a ordinary burden of proof, I think, faces a different preclusion analysis than we have here today.
Okay.
With regard to the disciplinary rule 20:5.5, prohibits a lawyer from practicing law in a jurisdiction where doing so violates the regulation of the legal profession in that jurisdiction. We do have a finding by the courts of Colorado, affirmed on appeal, that there was a violation of the rule, admittedly with a different burden of proof. For that reason, the OLR has not raised the issue of preclusion in this case, and that is basically because we don't want to have the decision in this case resting on a questionably legal proposition of preclusion. We are comfortable with the state of the record that was presented in the Colorado court, which in fact was made part of the record in this disciplinary case. I believe the entire transcript of the trial in Colorado is comprised in the voluminous exhibits to this, in this record, exhibits 4, 5, and 6, I believe, comprise the transcript. Exhibit 7, which is a binder, is, I think, approximately 700 pages of what comprise the exhibits in the Colorado litigation. We then turn to the legal standard. Well, how does Colorado define practicing law? The Costco versus Bolte case, the published case in Colorado at 30 Pacific 3rd at 786, quotes Denver Bar Association versus Public Utilities Commission.
Also, before you get there, what's your response to the argument I heard from opposing counsel in regard to the Spanos case? I take it that you must feel that Spanos does not absolve Mr. Bolte of his actions here, but I want to hear specifically why you think Spanos doesn't cover this situation.
I think we've addressed that in our brief, Justice Crooks, but briefly, I think to summarize it, I think the application or the attempted application of Spanos in this case is upside down or backward. The Spanos case, the holding in the case is that, and I think I can read it directly out of the decision. I'll give you a page cite to that, Your Honor. There's two passages of Spanos which I think are critical and clearly distinguish it from the facts we have here. At page 170, 364, Fed 2nd, 170, the court states, "For we hold that under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Constitution, no state can prohibit a citizen with a federal claim or defense," and that's distinguishing fact number one, "a federal claim or defense, from engaging an out-of-state lawyer to collaborate with an in-state lawyer and give legal advice concerning it within the state." At page 171 of Spanos, and this is really the last full paragraph of the decision, the court states,
We thus limit our holding to the situation here presented, where a citizen has invited a duly licensed out-of-state lawyer to work in association with a local lawyer on a federal claim or defense. The court goes on to say in that passage that this holding does not apply to diversity cases, and so on. Two key differences here. What we have in the case commenced by ARCO is a diversity case. It's not a federal claim or defense. These were issues of state law, and the Colorado Court of Appeals clearly says so in its decision. Secondly, Mr. Bolte was not invited to work in association with local counsel in Colorado. In fact, Mr. Bolte is the one who initiated the relationship with Ms. Koskov, and it was Mr. Bolte who brought Colorado counsel into the case months after, in fact, 6 months after he first signed the contract, which so the OLR contends.
You're saying that the relationship was initiated with Ms. Koskov by Mr. Bolte?
It was a relationship that the two of them reached before any local counsel was engaged.
Yes. In the agreement, as I understand, that the agreement called for, if they needed counsel, that they would get, you know, a Colorado lawyer. Wasn't that in the agreement? I'm talking about the initial agreement. He was not and did not hold himself out to be a lawyer that could do work in Colorado.
No, he did not hold himself out to be licensed in Colorado. That's true, Your Honor. However, I think that what's distinguishing about Spanos is that in the Spanos case, the client had an antitrust issue that was being investigated in New York. They already had a team of lawyers in New York working on it, and what they did was, in association with the client, they recruited an out-of-state lawyer from California who had expertise in antitrust matters to come and work in association with that team of lawyers in Colorado. And my point is here, what happened is that Mr. Bolte built the relationship with Ms. Koskov and then only later brought in Mr. Miller out of necessity in order to have a Colorado-licensed lawyer on the file.
Counsel, do you agree with opposing counsel that the only time span we need to look at is Mr. Bolte's activities from November of 94 to January of 95?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and I'll point out why. There is some confusion, I think, in the referee's decision on these so-called zones, but at the page mark 117 in the appellant's appendix, the referee explains what those three zones are, and he specifically says, this is the bottom paragraph of page 17 of the decision, that the first stage goes from November 22, 1994 to April 7, 1995.
Counsel, I thought the stage was different than that, and I thought I read someplace that the first stage went from November, when the agreement, the date of the agreement, until January 30th.
That's where the confusion comes in, Your Honor. Let me point out three places in the referee's decision. At page 105, numbered paragraph 12 of the findings, the referee states, on April 7, 1995, Koskov retained Miller to represent her relative to the ARCO lease dispute.
Just a moment. I want to find that. You said it's number...
That's page 105, finding 12.
I'm working from different briefs. So.
So you would extend the time to April 7th when Miller was hired in 95? Is that what you're looking at?
I think, Justice Rovensack, I think that's what the referee did. I think at one state, at one page, at page 112, he uses the date of January 30, but at two other places, he uses April 7. I think his intention was April 7, and we would submit that's supported by the record, and in particular, the testimony of Mr. Miller.
Okay, which, I just want to know the time span that you want us to look at his conduct, and the outside limit, as I understand it, is through April 7th of 95.
That's correct, Your Honor. The OLI's original position in this matter was January 2, but the referee ruled against us on that. Our reading of the referee's decision is that April 7 is the relevant date.
Thank you.
when I was asking the question, indeed I had before me the blue brief, page 112 of the appendix, looking at conclusion of law number one, and you responded to that. It seems to me that the conclusion of law here is, number one, that he engaged in unauthorized practice of law. And I read that as from that time period, during that time period. That's the...
Which is 3 months.
Well, which is November. It's November 20th. I don't know. It's November that the lease was signed, or the agreement was signed, I think, on the 22nd. But November, December, and January 30th. Why is that conclusion of law, or my reading of that, incorrect? What am I missing with regard to the conclusion of law that would expand the time period for which there was a finding of unauthorized practice?
Because in the discussion section, Your Honor, the referee specifically mentions activities after January of 1995 in explaining why he's concluding there was a violation. So I would submit that that really appears to be a typographical error as much as anything else.
Your opposing counsel suggests that it's not a typographical error, but rather it's inconsistent. I mean, there's a problem with it, it seems.
It may well be, and Your Honors, the court reviews the conclusions of law independently, and I think the court can define that date however the court sees fit based upon the facts of record, and we would ask that if there is any confusion about that date, the relevant date is and ought to be April 7, because as I was about to state, I think if the court looks at the record, the negotiation of the retainer agreement with Mr. Miller, the testimony of Mr. Miller regarding how he was retained and when he was retained, it is very clear that Mr. Miller was not brought into this case till April 7 of 1995 when Mr. Bolte negotiated on behalf of Ms. Koskove the retainer agreement.
So you would concede that after Miller comes into the case, we're not looking at any violations?
At this stage on appeal, Justice Butler, we will concede that. That was not our original position, but we'll concede up to April 7. And I think if the court reviews, again, the analysis of the referee at page 124, the referee is discussing activities that took place in March of 1995.
Let me focus my question. Is the conclusion of law set forth on page 112, number 1, is that incorrect?
In our view, it's incorrect or it's a misstatement, and it should read April 7, 1995, based upon the balance of the referee's decision.
Can it hold up even if you put in January 30th? Was there enough in your mind?
Yes, I still think there is, Your Honor. There's enough here, and we've cited in our brief literally what we did in our brief was to go through each of the specific items that the referee relied upon in his discussion section of the report and recommendation, beginning really at the middle of page 23, I think that discussion begins, where the referee explains where he believes Mr. Bolte overstepped the bounds of what could have been a permissible investigation and went beyond that.
Even if there is enough, it seems to me that the date is relevant to the four examples. The finding of unauthorized practice based on four examples, or the conclusion of unauthorized practice, is based on four examples. They're set forth on page 124 of the appendix, but on the face of it, two of those examples, example number one and example number three, fall outside the January 30th, 1995 date. That's the tension here, isn't
they,
it?
They do. I think, Your Honors, the OLR's view of this scenario is quite different than that presented by the appellant's counsel here. We take a broader view of this. We look at the contract. It's basically OLR's position, and we may differ slightly with the way the referee viewed this as a legal issue, but it appears to us, and this was the finding of the court in Colorado, that the basic agreement between Mr. Bolte and Ms. Koskov was itself an unauthorized, it was an unlawful agreement to practice law from the outset, and that any investigative services performed by Mr. Bolte were in fact incidental to the primary purpose of that contract, which under the definition in Colorado of the practice of law was itself, at its inception, an unlawful agreement to provide legal services.
Counselor, can't someone who is not licensed in the state write an agreement for one's own benefit without practicing law? I mean, this agreement was written by him for him. He's not really representing her in the agreement. Does that constitute the practice of law if he's just writing an agreement for himself?
If he's drafting the agreement? I don't believe the drafting services themselves constitute unauthorized practice.
Okay.
It's the services called for under the agreement that would.
Well, how is the services called for under the agreement different than the services that were drafted in the agreement?
The drafting of the agreement comes before any services are performed.
Well, I understand that, and my question to you was just writing the agreement, okay? And I understand your argument with regard to services performed later. My question goes back to whether or not drafting the agreement itself, just drafting the agreement before we go to the next day, was an unauthorized practice of law.
That's not our position, Your Honor.
Okay, and I just wanted to be clear.
Okay.
Okay. What services in the agreement, in your view, constitute the unauthorized practice of law? And you are looking at Colorado law, not Wisconsin law. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what precisely services in the agreement, and I assume they had to be done, because suppose I went out and said to a draft an agreement in California for myself saying, I'm going to represent you in court in California on this matter, and I'm not licensed and I can't do it. But then I never do anything else. It's just an agreement, and I don't do anything. That would not be a violation, would it, of anything?
Because you haven't acted.
That's right. So tell me what services in the agreement and what services that were actually performed you view as unauthorized practice of law in Colorado. And do you think Colorado's definition of unauthorized practice is really any different than Wisconsin's? Maybe you should answer that.
I'll answer that one first. I don't think there's any material
good difference. So we don't have to debate conflict of law. Okay. What services precisely?
Let me first do the definition so I can work that in.
Okay.
The first component is that the person who is accused of violating the rule is acting in a representative capacity.
Okay.
And I believe that the agreement here whereby Mr. Bolte is employed does put him in a representative capacity for Ms. Koskov. So that first step is satisfied. The next step is that the actions involve protecting, enforcing, or defending the legal rights and duties of another, and counseling, advising, and assisting him in connection with these rights and duties.
All right.
Our basic position is that Mr. Bolte, under this agreement, was counseling, advising, and assisting Ms. Koskov in protecting and enforcing her legal rights under the lease agreement with ARCO. And if one looks at the language of the agreement itself, it talks about investigating, examining, copying, analyzing, and interpreting. Interpreting, and I think that's very important. That's what lawyers do, interpreting whatever documents and records that relate to this lease contract.
What else?
The next key component is this, that the last clause in this sentence says, and pursue the proper payment thereof.
Okay.
And there was testimony in the record, it's cited in our brief, about how those words got into the contract, that Ms. Koskov was adamant that Mr. Bolte not simply do some hypothetical or theoretical interpretation of documents for her and then walk off into the sunset. And, in fact, Mr. Bolte specifically stated, and I believe this is in the record at page 131, it may be in the old Colorado record, but he stated that Ms. Koskov did not, let me find that. Ms. Koskov wanted me to go pound on their door, I think is the way he stated it.
Okay, here's my problem. Court held extensive hearings on a petition we had on unauthorized practice of law. And several entities and individuals came and said, if you consider that the practice of law, you're going to, I'm overstating this somewhat, but for this purpose, if you're going to consider this the practice of law, well, we're doing it and it's major part of our business, and what you're doing there in effect is saying we're out and we always have to have a lawyer. And people that came in included land use people who interpreted platting laws, looked at plats that were to be submitted, said they thought they did or didn't violate the platting laws, then went to see zoning administrators and boards to negotiate whether it was or wasn't and what we'd have to put in to do it. Financial advisors who interpreted, counseled, and advised on investments for estate tax, estate planning and taxing, et cetera. With that as a background to you, suppose that instead of Mr. Bolte being a lawyer, he was an investment advisor who was knowledgeable about oil and gas leases. There are such people. And he had an agreement with Ms. Costco that he would analyze what's happening in this area and counsel, advise, and assist her, and investigate, examine, analyze, and interpret her documents and what ARCA was doing. Would that be the unauthorized practice of law? That's, you know, you understand what's bothering me. Are we clipping him because he's a lawyer? But if he weren't a lawyer, maybe he would have been better off if he had just turned in his license here.
Well, I think that isolated and assuming different facts, there are ways in which Mr. Bolte could have provided some services to Ms. Koskov without running afoul of the prohibition. I mean, hypothetically, that could have happened, but in fact, he was not a CPA. He was not an expert in oil and gas leases. And that's why at the outset, Your Honor, my emphasis was that we believe the proper way to look at this contract is that the investigative services are incidental to the legal services here, because that's really what Mr. Bolte was qualified to do, was to act as a lawyer. And hypothetically, yes, and there's two other differences here with this language.
You're saying what he did was advise her as a lawyer of her legal rights against ARCO.
On a lease dispute, correct.
On a lease dispute. And that incidental to giving that legal advice, he did things that lawyers do or non-lawyers do, investigate.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And that the counsel advice and assist is as to legal advice. What was his legal advice?
I think the legal advice is reflected in the documents that the referee relied upon, where Mr. Bolte, for example, in the November 30 memoranda, he sets out an 8-point legal analysis concerning lease construction. This is at Supplemental Appendix 105 to 107. In January, he does what's called the formulas memorandum, and he's computing pricing formulas. He's talking about possible claims under antitrust law. He's addressing prejudgment interest rates that may apply if there is a recovery. That's something that lawyers do. He's talking about treble damages. He looks at court files in his January 3rd court file memo at Supplemental Appendix 117-119. He's analyzing those cases like a lawyer would do. He served discovery on ARCO. He, in fact, calls it discovery in the January 30th letter at Supplemental Appendix pages 120 to 126. These are really amount to requests for admissions tied to interrogatories and requests for production of documents.
Before a lawsuit is brought, after a lawsuit is brought, these discovery requests?
The discovery requests, these were ones that he served on ARCO by letter with a power of attorney that he drafted for the client, again showing that he's acting in a representative capacity for her. He's got meeting notes, which we've got at pages 127 to 129 of the supplemental appendix, and then there's the brief that I think Justice Butler alluded to earlier at pages 130 to 37, which again is an analysis of the lease dispute. It's the sort of memorandum that a lawyer would do, or a law clerk could do. And again, to get to a hypothetical scenario, Your Honor, under which Mr. Bolte perhaps could have lawfully performed services, had he simply served as a law clerk and gotten Mr. Miller involved in November of 1994, I don't think we'd have a problem here.
Is this also, an analysis that someone as an investigator, just investigator, could do? What would an investigator who was doing this, what kind of analysis would they have had?
I think if an investigator did anything beyond interviewing witnesses and started doing legal research and writing memos to the client, advising her on how contracts are interpreted, that investigator would be running afoul of unauthorized practice rules.
Counsel, if I could follow up a question, I believe, by Justice Crooks, and you may have already answered this, but I'm trying to get it. Since we're looking before April 7th of 95, why wouldn't Spanos relate back to this time period? I just want to make sure I understand your argument with respect to that.
Again, we don't think Spanos applies at all because it's backward and because it was not a situation where Mr. Bolte was brought in by the client working with a team of local lawyers. But what separates April 7 is that's the date when Mr. Miller is retained.
All right.
And the referee here, unlike the courts in Colorado, did give a partial relation back of the Spanos case to April 7, but not all the way, because that's when you had Colorado license counsel.
If I could ask one additional question, there seems to be something a little troubling about this case in the sense, as I understand it, it was Cosgrove that sought out Mr. Bolte ostensibly to get free legal advice, whatever, to get free services. That as a result of his services, she comes out of almost $2 million ahead, and because she disagrees with the fee arrangement and wants to keep all of the money, she brings the action. Is there anything at all, assuming that we agree that there's a violation of the rules here, is there anything at all about the fact that she comes in, or at least she may or may not have unclean hands, that should relate as to what we should do with this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Ms. Cosgrove isn't the lawyer. Mr. Bolte is the lawyer. Mr. Bolte, I think the record is clear here, knew that there was a potential problem with unauthorized practice. He presented one agreement by which he was supposed to get an interest in this land and somehow proceed pro se. She wasn't comfortable with that. I think Mr. Bolte, as a lawyer, has a duty, unlike the client. And in terms of, the and frankly, it's somewhat mudslinging at Ms. Cosgrove that's gone on here.
The facts, she sought him out.
She initially sought him out, but
she knew he wasn't a lawyer.
That's true, but Mr. Bolte knew he wasn't a lawyer, and Mr. Bolte did what plaintiff's lawyers do. He did a due diligence investigation. He found out there was a lot of money out here, and this was a great opportunity for him, and he got $388,000, and he has not paid that money back. If there's any confusion about that, I invite the court to read Mr. Dunlap's testimony. This money has not been paid back, and I'd further allude to the Colorado decision at 30 Pacific 3rd at 787. The court noted Mr. Bolte might have been able to establish that some of his activities were non-lawyer activities and thus have made a case for compensation for those particular activities. Mr. Bolte apparently chose to roll the dice on an all-or-nothing approach in defending this case in California, and he lost. I think the court here is saying if you had come up to us with an unjust enrichment claim and asked us to fairly compensate you for work that could be performed lawfully, he might have been able to keep some of that money and perhaps even a substantial amount. So that's a tactical decision he made.
Counselor, before you leave, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the fraudulent transfer, and we haven't done that. Do you want to very succinctly tell me what you'd like us to focus on? I read your brief, so you don't have to relate that to us again. There's something else that you wanted to add.
Okay. Well, very succinctly, Your Honor, this is a question of drawing factual inferences on Mr. Bolte's intent. The points we made that the referee accepted were you have a judgment on April 6. On April 13, Mr. Bolte transfers title to his property without telling anybody, even the grantee, that he's doing that. On April 16, he sues the court to try to enjoin judgment collection proceedings or execution proceedings, which would have put a stop to any attempts to collect that judgment. Now, Mr. Bolte admits that there's some relationship between the entry of the judgment and signing this deed, but the explanations that he gives for it simply don't make any sense other than to conclude that what's going on here is an attempt to protect an interest in property that may prove to be valuable by putting it in somebody else's name so the judgment creditor can't trace that property. The referee accepted the inference that that conduct was deceitful under 20:8.4 sub C.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Gimbel.
Thank you kindly. In response to the last comment with respect to Justice Rogenstack's concerns, I direct the Court to the case of Megabank Financial Corporation cited in our brief. It was a case that was decided at 841 Pacific 2nd, 318, and in particular, on page 3 of that particular decision, that court says, a debtor's intent and the good faith of the transferee are judged by the result as affecting the debtor's estate. The distinguishing feature of the fraudulent conveyance is that it unjustly diminishes the debtor's available estate, but on the other hand, the creditors have no right beyond that point. So long as the transfer does not diminish the estate, the motives of the debtor and grantee are immaterial. So to this case, Bolte does knee-jerk, as is recognized by referee Winarski, and transfers this property to his friend without first talking to the friend. It turns out, and the referee finds, based on the testimony of Mr. Dunlap and the testimony and records of Bolte, that this real estate had no equity. And so consequently, applying Colorado law to that transaction, it was not a fraudulent transaction, and whatever reason motivated Rick Bolte to write this deed out, anger, knee-jerk, whatever it was, it can't be the basis for finding of a fraudulent misconduct, and I assume that would apply to this case as well, in as much as the property had no value. Now, what ultimately happens is, and the record will disclose, is they reverse the transaction. The property is purchased by Ms. Costco at an auction in foreclosure, and in the course of that, some assets of Mr. Bolte that are being held in a 401k and pension plan with Merrill Lynch, I think it is, in Colorado, are seized, and they did collect something in the nature of $100,000. But the property, at the time of this hearing, before Mr. Winarski had been was in the possession of Ms. Costco with limited value. Now, with respect to the question of Spanos again, I think that ultimately becomes very relevant. As I suggested to you all, that I don't think it would be a waste of your time to read Judge Friendly's decision in the rehearing en banc in Spanos, because while I concede that Mr. Schwarzenbach has read appropriately
what might be considered a limitation on the application of Spanos. If you read Spanos in the context of what the trial judge said in that case, what the original Court of Appeals panel said in that case, and then what Friendly and his colleagues who constitute a majority said in reversing the Court of Appeals decision, you come to Justice Butler's concern here about clean hands, and I think that Spanos has a very substantial clean hands implication. I think that what Spanos is telling us is you states, you don't stick your nose in to a dispute about fees earned by a person using as the vehicle to undercut the claim for fees of somebody who rendered legitimate, honest services, your claim that this was unauthorized practice. It is almost an overlay on this case. And the essence of the conclusion that I believe you will reach is that once Bolte was admitted by the district court in Colorado on a pro hoc vice application, every single thing he did, from the day he met Carol Costco to the day she took away his money, was covered by the federal interest that is recognized in Spanos as saying that here is a place for a lawyer. The last thing that I would like to say is I'd like to react to the Chief's hypothetical situation. If you look at Keller, which this court decided, I think that what Keller instructs us, and I think what this court has instructed the state bar and those people who are trying to protect the turf of lawyers against real estate brokers and stockbrokers and bankers and accountants, I think that the unauthorized practice of law is not a small plot of ground or a large plot of ground that should be embraced by those of us who have licenses for no one else to get into. I heard, and maybe I didn't hear properly, but I heard in response to the Chief's question of Mr. Schwarzenbach that what I heard him say was that if this person that the Chief advanced, a person who has specialized knowledge on the area of mineral leases, were to have done the same thing Bolte did, but wasn't a lawyer, that probably would have passed muster in Colorado. And if that's the truth, once again, Bolte gets penalized in this proceeding, as he did in the proceeding in Colorado, for the incidental fact that he was a lawyer. I hope that you will consider our request for relief in this case, and I anticipate very considered judgment. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel, and thank you, Mr. Schwarzenbach, for your presentation in this unauthorized practice of law case involving federal courts in two different states. That closes our hearing on 03-1184-D, OLR versus Bolte. Thank you both, and we'll proceed to our second case today relating to lawyer discipline.